Today I'm disappointed and heartbroken and disgusted, but I'm no longer surprised. And probably I never should have been. But we know that one thing privilege gives you is the privilege to be surprised when awful things happen. And we no longer have the luxury, if ever we did, of being surprised. Not surprised that white supremacy surrounds us, or that white nationalists and neo-Nazis march in the streets of our country with torches, or that violence breaks out in the middle of a rally, or even that violence ends in death for one peaceful protester, killed by a white supremacist terrorist who ran into her at high speed with his car and injured 20 others. Or even surprised that two law enforcement officers die in what is apparently a tragic accident, a helicopter crash, while they were responding to the violence. And perhaps least surprised that in response to this, our nation's president first tweets a rather lukewarm call for unity, and then later speaks to condemn violence on, and I quote, many sides. In fact, let me give you the whole thing. He said, "We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides." And he said it again, on many sides, to make it clear that that was his real point. So again, I wish I could still be surprised. The false equivalence of this is mind-boggling to me, to say that, and I quote here the writer Josh Levin, "counter-protesters, those marching for the proposition that all men are created equal, are apparently part of the problem too." To make that your claim is both insulting and dangerous, frankly. This isn't like choosing whether you like chunky or smooth peanut butter. There aren't a bunch of equally valid, equally responsible sides here. We know this. And it's foolishly optimistic to think that you could even be neutral or ambivalent here. There is no middle ground between all people have inherent worth and dignity, as we proclaim, and that they don't, as white supremacists argue, no matter what euphemisms or language they try to say to get around that. Our faith calls us to get engaged, not stay on the sidelines. As the writer and survivor of the Shoah, otherwise known as the Holocaust, Elie Wiesel put it, take sides. Neutrality helps only the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. And let me be clear, when I talk about sides, I'm not talking Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives or whatever split we've been hearing about lately, because fascism, Nazism, white supremacy are unacceptable, period. End of sentence. I thought that used to go without saying, but it apparently doesn't any longer. But even so, it's too easy to say that there's a good side and a bad side or a right and a wrong side, and not because I think these horrific, awful wannabe Nazis have something worthwhile to say, nor is it because I'm engaging in some sort of moral relativism of the sort you might hear. Just the opposite, because the thing is, fascists don't have a side. There is nothing in what they say or do that is worth the effort it takes for them to do it. Again, this isn't some issue where there are different sides with competitive narratives that are both worthy of attention. It's not chocolate versus cookies and cream. It's cookies and cream versus untreated sewage. There aren't two sides, there's only one side, and that's the side of humanity. So when we see white supremacists marching and chanting racist and homophobic and anti-immigrant slogans, they aren't supporting some side of an issue that we or anyone should consider with an open mind. No, they have failed the side that we're all on, the side of humanity. They have jumped ship, not from one side to another, but from the side we're all on over to nothing. There is no side there. Because as warped and misguided as they are, it's tempting to write them off completely, but actually what we need to do is trying to bring those folks back into the fold, to be shown the error of their ways, to have their hearts changed, whether we can do it, or God can do it, or the universe can do it. I believe it can happen. So we oppose their views and their actions, and we will continue to do so. And still we strive to honor the humanity they have. That's a difficult thing to ask, I know. But to do anything less would betray ourselves, betray who we are called to be. You heard earlier that the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, the UUA president, was with several UU ministers and lay people in Charlottesville yesterday, and she spoke to this. She wrote in a note late last night, "Today was a tragic day, a day that ended in the loss of life and in a city left reeling. We lift in our prayers the family of the person who lost their life. We lift up their community, all the people injured and traumatized by the events, especially my siblings of color and those who identify as transgender, queer, lesbian, gay, and bisexual, and the city and community of Charlottesville. And two, we lift in our hearts a prayer that for all those whose spirits have been distorted by fear and violence, that they may come to know the capacity for love in their own hearts and spirits. Because as a people of faith, it is this overflowing, deep, abiding love that must guide us to show up again and again for justice, for inclusion, for dignity, and for humanity." And so last night, Kristen and I and several UUCBers joined a beautifully diverse crowd of hundreds of people in downtown Oakland to proclaim our solidarity with the people of Charlottesville and to condemn fascist violence there. Kristen and I had to leave a little early in order to hurriedly revamp the service for you today, so we didn't actually make the march part so much as the gathering part, but I thank those of you who could stay for the whole thing. But the words of a teenager at that solidarity event last night really impressed me and have stuck with me. She said, and I hope you'll forgive me if I don't paraphrase her perfectly, she said, "The person who killed someone in Charlottesville yesterday was taught to hate like this. Fascists and neo-Nazis who rallied there were raised in a culture that told them it was okay to do the things they did this weekend." And to continue her thoughts with my own, it's not a random or bizarre thing that this happened, as awful as it is. The culture these fascists come from is the same one we come from, albeit reflected through a warped prism into the horrific ideology they espouse. And so, as difficult as it is, as tempting as it is to look away, we have to again examine our own biases and our own backgrounds and our own assumptions, not because I imagine any of us are about to go rally with Nazis, but because white supremacy and racism and oppression are insidious and all around us all the time. And if we try to remain ignorant of that, to try to ignore that, we merely perpetuate their existence. And that then is on all of us, especially those of us who identify as white. We have to do better. As that young woman at the rally implored us to do, we have to have those conversations with our children and with our neighbors, with those we disagree with. Though the prospects of our nation's struggles get me down, that gives me hope, because as she was saying that, I thought, we don't do it perfectly here, but we do that. At this congregation, the people I see here, I know we are having those conversations. We talked about people with diverse sexual orientations and gender identities, and we did the work to become an official welcoming congregation. We're talking now and have been about racism and white supremacy, about how we affirm that Black Lives Matter and that structural racism is real. We're talking to some degree, and hopefully more, about how classism and how poverty and how violence and how all these intersecting forms of oppression affect us and our world and what we might do about it. It's so easy in our culture to fall for the lie that every issue we talk about in the social or political or economic arena is discrete and separate. But folks, remember, there's only one side because all of that stuff is connected. And so when I say there's only one side, that of humanity, I mean that healthcare access and immigration, homophobia and racism, poverty and classism are different issues, yes, but all deeply interrelated. None of us is free until all of us are free, as the poet Emma Lazarus put it. Or, to phrase it a little differently, my colleague, the Reverend Teresa Inez Soto, says, all of us need all of us to survive. So to be on the side of humanity means more than just saying so, because what are we to do about it? As A. Pal Davies asks us from 60 years ago. How are we to ensure that we're not inadvertently failing the side of humanity? I share again words I shared some months ago from this pulpit from the Unitarian minister and theologian James Luther Adams, who spent time in 1930s Germany. He said, "Let me put it autobiographically and say that in Nazi Germany, I soon came to the question, what is it in my preaching and my political action that would stop this?" He continues, "It requires a sense that there is something wrong and that I must be different from the way I have been." So what is it in our daily actions that would stop fascism? What is it in the way we are living that supports humanity and decency and justice and compassion? What am I doing that would prevent what I fear we are seeing happen right in front of us? I give you more words from Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. "This is a pivotal moment in our nation," she says. "I am here to show up on the side of love because this is a time when violence, fear, and radicalized hate have been given permission. It is important for people of conscience to say that love and equity is our future, because faith calls us to see the humanity in one another. The Christian scriptures," she says, "call us to love our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus says that even our enemies are our neighbors, and that this kind of radical, unconditional love is the one we are called to live out as people of faith towards one another." And so ends her words. So we're here to say that love and justice is the future, and we can make it so. We can start by calling out what this rally in Charlottesville and others like it really is, including one scheduled for Berkeley on August 27th, 2 weeks from today. They're fascist Nazi BS. And so there's already a counter-protest planned, and I'm attending a planning meeting this week for another counter-protest, which might end up being combined so that we have one solid counter-protest rather than many small ones. And so soon you'll hear information from me about how we can participate in telling these people that hate is not welcome in this community. And I tell you, as a church minister and someone who has to deal with the logistics of church, that might mean rescheduling some things that we had already planned for that day, possibly including our first mission and vision meeting, which I was really excited about. But if our mission doesn't include opposing hate here and now, then that's not the right mission for us anyway. So look for a reschedule of that, perhaps. So as you wait to hear more about those specific plans for the next couple weeks, I invite you to consider the ways our congregation is already involved in this work, ways that anyone can join in to the degree they are able. If you've never been to a ceasefire walk, consider joining us one Friday night. I've only been to one, so you're not very far behind me. Consider joining us to serve lunch at the Greater Richmond Interfaith Program, popularly known as GRIP, something we've been a part of doing for decades. Consider coming to the social justice meeting tonight and being a part of the planning work they're doing that involves so many different activities. You can look at our social justice table today, too, to see the great span of things we're working on in our world and in our local communities. And consider how in your day-to-day life you can do this work, too. Studies have again and again shown that many Americans, especially white Americans, have few interactions and even fewer relationships with people who are different from them. So think about how you can reach over differences of race or class or age and make connections, because it's clear to me that this is a vital piece of this work. And one of the things I was most excited about coming to this congregation a year ago is knowing that in the Bay Area, you do not have to go very far to find someone radically different from you. In any imaginable and conceivable way you can think of. It's clear to me that this is a vital piece of our work too, the building of relationships one-on-one that build up to something greater. So as important as being here in our church community is on Sunday, and I thank you all for being here, it's only a part of what we must do. So stay tuned for the ways we're called to be on the side of humanity in coming days and weeks, and examine your own life. What in my actions, in my living, would stop what we're seeing happening? What am I doing to promote the work of love and justice in the world, however large or small my part may be? And two, what has been my role in allowing oppression to continue? So I quote from our reading this morning from A. Powell Davies, "As you have listened to me, have you thought perchance that this is your religion? If you have, do not congratulate yourself. Stop long enough to recollect the miseries of the world we live in, the fearful cruelties, the enmities, the hate, the bitter prejudices, the need of such a world for such a faith. And if you can still say that this thing we have spoken of is your religion, then ask yourself this question: what are we doing with it?" Friends, this is what we're called to do the work of love and justice in the world, to call out bigotry, to support equality, to become the change we wish to see in the world, because we can do no less. So let's be the change we wish to see. Amen.